Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This is a bonus episode following the resignation of the First Minister of Scotland, Humza Yousaf. And my guest today is Ewan McComb, who's a fantastic political writer in Scotland, but not just in Scotland. He writes for The Spectator as well as The Scotsman, The Scotland Sunday, and The Press and Journal, and various other. You'll have read him in so many other newspapers. A brilliant writer. And he's a great assessor of Scottish politics. So this is a thorough assessment of reasons why Humza Yousaf, what happens next for the SNP, what happens next in Scottish politics. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm also delighted, before we check in with Ewan, to announce that I will be returning to stand-up, which is very exciting. I'm doing the Edinburgh Festival this summer. Tickets for that will be on sale soon. And I'm doing some work-in-progress gigs in London. I'm doing five nights at the Soho Theatre from the 28th of May to the 1st of June. And I've put the link in the blurb for you to be able to click on that and buy tickets. It's been quite a while since I was flogging tickets and doing the hard sell on the podcast, so it's a pleasure to return to that. But yes, it's obviously the final bit of work that I've not been able to do yet. I can podcast and things, but because of the fact that I can't walk properly yet, so I will probably have a stick or two on stage with me. So hecklers beware. But five nights at the Soho Theatre from the 28th of May with a work in progress show that I'll then be taking to the Edinburgh Festival and then on tour. So a bit emotional, really, because it's obviously proof that I'm sufficiently healed that I can do it. So I just can't wait. So tickets available now if you click on the link. Without further ado, a brilliant chat about the changing state of politics in Scotland with the brilliant Ewan McComb.
Ewan, why did today unfold the way that it did? Why did Humza Yousaf's resignation happen at this point?
It happened because he had pulled the pin on his first ministership in spectacular fashion last Thursday. So we went 3 years. Nicola Sturgeon is the leader of a minority administration at Holyrood, and she spent years telling her supporters that she's going to give them another referendum. But she can't give them another referendum. So she thinks, wait a minute, I've got an idea. She cooks up a deal to bring the Scottish Greens into government. That gives her pro-independence majority at Holyrood. And so she thinks, well, now I can argue that I've got a mandate for a referendum. But unsurprisingly, Westminster says, no, you don't. So she's got this partnership with the Greens. It gives her a pro-independence majority and offers her some protection against votes of confidence. Now, before she had that partnership with the Greens, she had protection against votes of confidence because there's no way the Greens as a pro-independence party would have voted alongside the Tories, Labour, the Lib Dems, any unionist party that had wanted to bring down an independence administration. So she brought them on board at a time when she didn't really have to. This was a real belt and braces thing. And over the 2 years before Nicola Sturgeon stepped down, increasing numbers of SNP members got hacked off about the Greens' presence. I mean, there's basic things, basic jealousy. You know, there are SNP backbenchers who's saying, well, wait a minute, there are two Green ministers. I could have one of those jobs. And then you've got people who are genuinely worried about policy. So the SNP becomes a powerful force in Scottish politics back in 2007, not by being some radical party, but by being quite similar to New Labour, by moving into the centre ground and being cautious and recognising that there's a small C conservative middle Scotland, just the same as there's a small C conservative middle England. So SNP, MSPs in kind of increasing numbers are worried about the impact of the Greens' influence on government, because the Greens, although ostensibly a party focused on the environment in Scotland and in elsewhere, are really big on sort of controversial gender ideology issues, and that had become a hugely controversial issue in Scotland. We had Nicola Sturgeon, with the support of the Greens, pushing through reforms to the Gender Recognition Act to allow self-ID, a piece of legislation that was unworkable and ended up being blocked by the Scottish Secretary, Alistair Jack. And all the while, you've got SNP MSPs saying, hold on, this isn't the stuff that won us power. The stuff that won us power was understanding that kind of boring, unsexy thing of being a family with a, you know, it's perfectly honourable to want to have a nice house in a tidy estate and maybe have two cars in the driveway. You know, so those MSPs who remembered that and remembered that that was the sort of focus that helped them get to power were getting increasingly frustrated about the Greens. Now, for want of a better word, woke agenda, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with being woke. But, you know, in the kind of modern parlance, very angry about what they saw as the Greens' woke agenda. So increasing pressure on Hamza Youssef to do something about that. Rather than at the start of his first ministership deciding that, you know, maybe he could have a proper restart, he decided to become a sort of, try to be a continuity first minister. So he continues with Nicola Sturgeon's obsessions and continues this relationship with the Greens. And that's, you know, he's able to kind of struggle along, but no one's getting any happier on the SNP backbenches about this agreement. And finally, when the Cass report comes out 2 weeks ago, there are a lot of people in the SNP who are now feeling that they can speak up about their concerns about gender ideology, concerns about some of the government's priorities. And at this point, Patrick Harvey, the co-leader of the Scottish Greens, is on BBC Scotland Sunday morning programme and is asked about the Cass report. And he refuses to say that he accepts it's a valid scientific document. And all hell breaks loose in SNP ranks over this. At the same time, the LGBT wing of the Scottish Greens starts the call for a ban on puberty blockers in Scotland being lifted. They want that to happen. All of this stuff is infuriating SNP MSPs, who I think not unreasonably feel that the Scottish government, when Cass reported, should have said, look, we've read this and we're paying attention, but instead ignored it for days and then said, well, look, we'll get to it. And then, Hamza Youssef did nothing when Patrick Harvey then tried to sort of diminish the worth of the report on television. So at this point, it was becoming clear that Youssef's backbenchers weren't going to have much of this. I wrote a piece in The Scotsman last week, which was full of asterisks because it's a family newspaper, just about the anger that SNP backbenchers felt about the Greens' influence on government. And this anger was exacerbated by a decision of the Greens to schedule a meeting at which their members would get to have a say on the future of the power-sharing agreement at Holyrood. And at this point, Hamza Youssef thought, well, hold on a minute, I'm not going to wait until you decide to chuck me. I'm going to chuck you. And instead of trying to negotiate some kind of amicable separation, he decided to call the co-leaders of the Scottish Green Party, Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater, into his office at 8:30 last Thursday morning, sacked them, and then sent them out into the cold in front of the TV cameras and expected that everything would be fine. But what happened was that Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater found the first available TV cameras and started to describe all the many and varied ways in which Hamza Youssef was an appalling and untrustworthy man. And before long, the Scottish Tories had decided that what they would do is they would lodge a motion of no confidence in Humza Yousaf. And that's a bit of a wheeze because it's not actually binding, that vote at the Scottish Parliament. But the fact is, you'd still want to pass it. And the Greens made clear that actually they would be happy to vote with the Tories. So did Labour and the Liberal Democrats. So that left Humza Yousaf, given the numbers in Holyrood, one last option, and that was to try and win over the support of Ash Regan, who was an SNP MSP, came third to him in the contest to Nicola Sturgeon, and then defected to ALBA, which is a rival pro-independence party, or depending on your appetite for that kind, this kind of thing, an Alex Salmond rehabilitation front to get Alex back into the political front line. Now, for various reasons, huge breakdown in relationships between Alex Salmond and the SNP. The fact that he'd spent years working for Russia Today after being First Minister, and the fact that he'd been involved in a high-profile court case. You know, he was cleared of a number of charges, but it was a messy and unpleasant court case, and there were things said about his character, which a lot of people said, and the SNP felt kind of meant that he really had to remain yesterday's man. So Humza Yousaf's option is to try and do a deal with Ash Regan, but in doing that, upset so many of his SNP colleagues who are not at all interested in letting Alex Salmond back into the debate, that he loses support that way. So he ended up in an impossible position.
But it's a position that was so much of it has its roots with the decisions that Nicola Sturgeon took, particularly to bring two people who to a lot of people seem totally unsuited to top-level politics, Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater. Two people that, as you say, would have voted for most of Nicola Sturgeon's stuff anyway on the floor of Holyrood. And surely Nicola Sturgeon must have known that these people were inappropriate, but overlooked that inappropriateness purely because they agreed with her on the Constitution.
Absolutely. And because at that time, you know, Nicola Sturgeon's dominance of the SNP was complete. And, it, you know, I think, don't you find that with those kind of really dominant political figures, often there's a lack of self-reflection?
Yeah.
Because they're never challenged. And so, you know, maybe maybe part of their success is that self-belief, but it's also a real downside. And I think Nicola Sturgeon is, like a lot of successful politicians, guilty of that. So you know, I don't think she thought about the consequences of bringing the Greens in. But that stage in the Nicola Sturgeon story, she was right about everything. She could do no wrong. She had really lost touch with what people in the party and people in the country really cared about. And she was also desperate on the independence question. She'd promised and promised and promised a referendum that she couldn't deliver. The fact that she couldn't deliver it was then confirmed by the courts after the Scottish government challenged the UK government to allow them to have a referendum. So she was kind of, you know, she was running out of road on that argument, and she felt that by bringing the Greens on board, she could make that argument that there was a mandate, that this was a majority government. Now, you know, in 2011, the SNP won a majority, and that was enough for the Prime Minister of the day, David Cameron, to say, okay, fair enough, Alex Salmond, you've won the right to have a referendum. But that was a kind of gentleman's agreement. You know, the rules don't say that the Prime Minister has to give the First Minister the right to hold a referendum. And David Cameron gave Alex Salmond the right to hold a referendum because David Cameron was pretty confident that Alex Salmond wouldn't win a referendum. And unfair as it might be, and nationalists have been crying foul about this for a long time, the fact is that the race is a bit closer now, and no Prime Minister is going to want to give the SNP a referendum that, you know, they might win. That's politics. You know?
Yeah, and so much of the backdrop as well is to this is not just the seeds that were sown by Nicola Sturgeon in Bute House, but also in the party. And She was obviously arrested. Her husband has just been charged effectively with embezzlement. I mean, that as well, you know, people felt for Humza a little bit that he'd taken over and clearly hadn't been. Well, he says he wasn't told about the motorhome. And he said he didn't know about a lot of that stuff. And given how close the race was between him and Kate Forbes, you can't help but feel that had that contest happened a week later, when more information came to light, that actually he might not have ended up being First Minister at all. So the SNP membership maybe is offside with the whole Sturgeon project now.
Well, I mean, the Sturgeon project isn't what it was, you know. It's obviously tarnished. I don't think Humza Yousaf knew anything about the police investigation. I don't think he knew this was... I certainly don't think he knew that it was likely to develop the way that it did. That came as a shock to him. And in fairness, you know, any politician would struggle over a year where every day when you wake up, when they woke up, you didn't know whether your predecessor was about to be arrested or rearrested or charged. I mean, that's a really horrendous way to start every morning for a political leader. But that aside, Humza Yousaf is, as political leaders go, he's a dog that caught the car. You know, so he got the job and he didn't have anything. He didn't know what to do with it. He had no big idea. So he gets the job, he says it's a great honour, then he'll be a leader for all Scotland, and then he tells SNP voters that he'll be first activist and G's them up. And then he just doesn't do anything. There's just no vision. So one of the first big things he gets involved with is to keep the Green Party happy, really costly and entirely futile, because he'd been advised that it would not work, an entirely futile legal challenge on the block and the Gender Recognition Act. And, you know, you've got an electorate sitting there thinking, no, guys, look, we've told you. Stop polling us if you're not going to pay attention. Stop polling us. And every time you poll us, we say to you, it's the cost of living crisis, it's the NHS and education. Well, we've told you this countless times, and you're still obsessed with this stuff. So, you know, that was the mistake from day one. You know, I said in a piece at the weekend that it sort of suited him to be seen as the continuity candidate, but his big mistake was to try to be the continuity First Minister. Nicola Sturgeon had said when she resigned last year, look, I have recognised that I've come to the point where I've become this divisive figure. And the things that made her that polarising character were her policies. It was the obsession with the referendum she couldn't deliver. And it was her obsession with reform for the Gender Recognition Act and dismissal of concerns of lesbians and various other feminist campaigners and gay men and parents, and just a whole group, a whole bunch of different groups that had various reasons for thinking some of the gender reform stuff was problematic. So there was no new beginning. On Thursday, he said in his speech when he announced the end of the Butte House Agreement, this is a new beginning, and his new beginning lasted until lunchtime today. His time for a new beginning was last year when he took over. Another thing that he should have done, and Nicola Sturgeon should have done, and whoever takes over must do, is that they must be honest, not just with the, you know, their opponents, who we all know, you know, everyone that's a skeptic about independence already knows that there's not going to be another referendum, but there is a core of the SNP support that still believes a referendum is just around the corner. And the next SNP leader has to be honest with these people and say, look, it's not, and that there's really hard work to be done. I'm not sure if they'll have the courage to do it. You know, even as Yousaf was announcing his resignation today, he said that, you know, independence is frustratingly close. Independence is further away than it's been since long before the referendum in 2014, and support for it is falling by the day.
But isn't this the fundamental problem they have, that whoever takes over, that there is a cultural problem at the heart of the SNP, which is to basically ignore difficult facts, whether it's about the economic case for independence, the likelihood of another referendum, And when you look back, you know, you talk about them being like New Labour, and I understand that in terms of understanding the small-C conservative nature of Scotland. But the key difference between the two parties is New Labour delivered some really radical, country-changing stuff, and even SNP members sometimes struggle to really name anything.
You're absolutely right.
They leave with so little achieved, which is bizarre.
Yeah, but it was like a sort of facsimile of New Labour. It was like a sort of New Labour tribute act at Pontins on a Wednesday afternoon. So, you know, they kind of, they were like bad cover versions of the songs, but no substance, and they didn't have the choruses. So you got kind of things which, whereas New Labour understood the existence of a kind of aspirational Middle England and respected that, and you know, Blair, I think you could say, kind of found a way of negotiating with that huge influential part of the electorate, ways of moving forward progressive policies while looking after their self-interest. I mean, that's the New Labour project, isn't it, kind of? So the SNP looked at that, but they didn't want to put the effort into the kind of policy side of it. They wanted to get those same voters on board. So they offered them some nice freebies, you know, sort of free tuition fees for university. So that goes, that disproportionately benefits the wealthy. They extended the provision of free prescriptions to include everyone, which basically meant giving free prescriptions to the wealthy. So they did things which benefited those same kind of self-interested middle Scotland voters, but they didn't do it with policies of substance that kind of made any kind of great improvement to society. They did it actually by, you know, cutting budgets in councils and cutting a lot of services that impacted some of the most vulnerable people. It's a remarkable thing. I'm not saying that all English political commentators are idiots. I'm not saying that. But it's always interesting when Nicola Sturgeon would appear on a UK television programme. Twitter would be full of people saying, oh, isn't she great? Can't we get someone like her down here? She's so amazing and progressive. Look how progressive she is. She can't stop progressing. And they would absolutely lose their minds over it. And you say, well, actually, hold on a minute. Come up here and read the sort of page 7 lead in The Scotsman or the page 11 in The Press and Journal, where you hear about more cuts to vital services for disabled kids or for people with addiction problems.
Do you think statistics
about deaths through overdose? Or this terrible record that Nicola Sturgeon had.
Do you think SNP politicians and members realise that they're not really that progressive?
Nationalism is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it sort of allows you to tell yourself whatever you want you to be. You know, it's all about reverse engineering. So if you think the answer to all ills is independence, then anything that gets you there is by its nature a progressive act, isn't it? Well, I think that's what you tell yourself if you're driven by that ideology. You know, I've been covering politics for, you know, 30-odd years now. And in that time, I've seen the SNP on countless occasions completely reverse policy positions with a click of the fingers because they judged that actually the opposing position was more beneficial to the independence argument. So, yeah, I think they probably do think that they're progressive because what could be more progressive than being a progressive, independent Scotland, the best wee progressive country in the world?
What's your assessment of where they go from here? Because they seem to have basically, I mean, I know they reverse ferret like no one, but their whole sort of pitch for a while has been, if you want to get rid of the Tories, you need to have an independent Scotland. And that's been highly effective for them, certainly at Holyrood and Westminster elections, if not in the referendum of 2014. But if their whole pitch is basically England is this forever Tory place, at the next election, it doesn't look like that's going to be the case.
Yeah.
It looks like England's going to vote Labour. And now they're going to have to completely shift their message. As they were trying to go, well, England's going to vote Labour, and we all know that's going to happen. So you better vote SNP up here to we
just
can't
keep Labour. Keep them honest.
Do they realise that they've really really hemmed themselves in with some pretty shoddy arguments?
Do you know, Matt, I think that stuff's kind of now out of date.
Yeah.
I think things have now, they've taken such a bleak turn for them as a party that that stuff's now the least of their worries. So the polls had told us for some time that the SNP were going to lose seats at the general election, and that the likelihood was that Labour would get most seats. But SNP members were consoling themselves with polls that showed that they were still on course probably to win the 2026 Holyrood election. Not with a majority, but as the largest of a parliament of minorities. But I have to say that speaking to contacts in the SNP over the last 72 hours, people who have been around long enough to remember the bad days as well as the good days, the mood is really, really bleak. The feeling is that what's happened over the last few days has been, I think this is a reasonable assessment, incredibly damaging, because we've seen a First Minister sort of explode his own career, give away what little authority he had, and then humiliate himself, sort of begging his opponents for support before walking away. You've got 20 years of discipline in the SNP, now SNP absolutely shattered. Those arguments about whether it should be a fundamentalist approach of independence, nothing less, or that gradualist approach of, you know, gaining more power through devolution, that's back. And to add to that big split, there's now a kind of, I don't know if you want to say it's a cultural, or maybe I think more realistically actually a sort of generational split, with young SNP members being more inclined to agree with the Greens on issues like reform of the Gender Recognition Act, and older SNP members thinking that the party should never have got involved with the matter in the first place. So on top of all that, you've got the Greens making it clear that there are certain candidates, Kate Forbes, for example, a devout member of the Free Church of Scotland, with conservative views about gay marriage and other equality issues. They made it clear that they couldn't support a vote to put her in as First Minister, and given the numbers, you know, it could actually be down to the Greens to dictate who the next SNP leader is. That's a pitiful place for the party, which the sort of bullish Alex Salmond once led, to find itself where, you know, they don't even at the moment have a free run at choosing their own leader without the Greens getting in the way. And speaking to someone who has who's worked in headquarters in the past and is a really successful campaigner who feels, and I'm inclined to agree, that if the SNP loses a Holyrood election to Labour, the effect will be absolutely devastating on the party. The SNP has been so successful for so long that among the kind of current generation, you know, Hamza Yousaf has never known defeat. You know, he's a guy in his 30s, you know, who was leading a party which, you know, came to power, you know, not after he'd left school. You know, it's a party full of people who have always taken victory for granted, and I don't think they're at all well prepared for it. And certainly that's what contacts of mine within the party fear and believe is going to happen.
And do you think then, you know, just as we look ahead to the UK election and wonder what will happen to the Tories in opposition, the SNP in opposition, do they then effectively go to the fundamentalist route? Are they going to do in opposition what parties tend to do, which is effectively become a more extreme version of the thing they were in government?
I don't think so. I think that that tendency doesn't really exist among those MSPs who might be the kind of likely candidates. There's been some talk about Jenny Gilruth, the Education Secretary. Most of your listeners wouldn't have heard of Jenny Gilruth for very good reason.
I think listeners to this podcast...
I think a very...
A well-genned up on Scottish politics.
I don't mean to be cruel, but she's not been an impressive Education Secretary. But then Hamza Yousaf was unimpressive in a number of roles and it didn't stop him becoming First Minister, so I don't suppose that might be a barrier. So Jenny Gilruth's one possible runner. There's obviously speculation about Kate Forbes, but that could be messy when it came to the vote for First Minister. Stephen Flynn, the Westminster leader, has ruled himself out. But there are others that might pop up. But, you know, there is no one that's waiting there in the wings for the SNP who's about to come in and rescue that. There's no big character. There's no one who's going to inspire a nation and who's going to change their minds about the SNP. You know, the SNP is in decline, and, well, you know, everyone that listens to this podcast that follows politics knows that once a major party has started to decline, that only ends one way.
Yes. In terms of who could lead them, then, is John Swinney their best bet?
Well, I mean, for a short term bet, potentially. I don't think it's realistic to expect him to take it on to stand as a candidate. If you know, Hamza Yousaf has said that he'll look after the shop until his successor is found. You know, John Swinney's made it clear when he stepped down as Deputy First Minister that, you know, he'd put in his shift, that he'd stayed longer in Holyrood than he'd wanted. And, you know, and he's got all sorts of, you know, personal reasons that he wanted to sort of lighten his workload at Holyrood. And I don't think much has changed to shift that balance. So I can understand why people in the SNP are talking about him, because there are very few candidates that are even vaguely credible. But I'm not sure that John Swinney would want it. I'm not sure it would be fair to put pressure on him to take it.
Just because, just before we recorded this, we're having this conversation, I'd seen him on Sky saying he was weighing up his options. I don't know if he seems to be considering it a bit more than maybe...
You know, he's when it comes down to it, John will, I suppose he will, he's a very loyal party man, and he is absolutely committed. He's absolutely committed to independence. For all of us, the way that he presents as a moderate, years ago when he was leader of the SNP, so this would be 20 years ago, I was at a conference and he was doing a turn, and it was very kind of new SNP, very moderate and reaching out and touchy-feely, and it's great to be British as well as Scottish. You know, I love Eccles cakes and, you know, that
thing. Morris dancing.
That sort of thing.
Football hooliganism.
He came on stage brandishing a Savoy. but he was doing all that, and it was all very, you know, very jolly. And one of his then advisors was sitting beside me and whispered, don't forget, he'd live in a fucking cave to be free. So, in the heart of John Swinney, as in the heart of all nationalists, really, is that that's the dream. So, maybe that's enough. Maybe that's enough for John. But it just shows you what a dearth of talent they have. That if John Swinney became leader, then the recent run of leaders would have been, the run of leaders in the last sort of 20 years would be Alex Salmond, John Swinney, Nicola Sturgeon, caretaker, Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon, Hamza Yousaf briefly, and then John Swinney again. You know,
why is there a lack of talent then? Because they've had more seats than any other party for quite a period of time now.
Well, you know, the SNP's always been a broad church, hasn't it? By which I mean, there's always been a very few people that kind of are, if you like, sort of romantic, intellectual nationalists at the top of it. And then a lot of blood and soil nationalists. And you don't find good quality candidates among blood and soil nationalists because they don't actually care about other things. Because nationalism, you know, the freedom is everything. And everything else can wait. So so that's why. So you've had a party which for years has had a very few people at the top with any curiosity about policy issues. You know, and then you've had these kind of lobby fodder members. And you have to say at the moment, you know, in this, across the parties of the Scottish Parliament, they are all struggling with a lack of fresh new talent. They all started off, I think, fairly well. You know, most of the parties sent experienced parliamentarians north from Westminster to Holyrood in 1999. But over the years, those more experienced figures have gone and been replaced by and large by a sort of professional political generation who have kind of come up through student politics into a kind of SPAD job and then an elected member. And in the case of the SNP, that's so a whole generation of politicians who have never really had to fight for anything. They just had to turn up and Nicola won their seat for them. And so these are people that haven't really been tested. And, you know, under Nicola Sturgeon and John Swinney, it was hardly a secret that they were micromanaging just about every cabinet secretary's workload because they had so little faith in the abilities of the men and women that were sitting around the table with them.
What about Salmond then and his partial rehabilitation amongst certain nationalist circles? I mean, this is someone who, as you say, even part of his defence wasn't at times a character defence of himself during his legal trial, and then works for Russia Today. I can't believe that he still is around. I mean, is this someone who is genuinely trying to become first minister again, or kind of at least be, in his way, control the next first minister?
Well,
or is this just another? Is this him trying to? Is it purely just about him being able to rehabilitate himself a little bit so he can make money elsewhere?
I think it's. I think first and foremost, it's about damaging the SNP because he'll never forgive senior figures in the SNP for the way he feels that they betrayed him over the allegations that were made about him and the way they responded. So he feels very strongly, and they would argue that they did nothing of the sort, and I would sympathise with that, but he feels very strongly that they betrayed him. So Alex Salmond knows that there was no way that Humza Yousaf could agree to a single thing he asked for him. Alex Salmond knows that fine and well. When Alex Salmond was on television on Sunday, he wasn't trying to negotiate an agreement with Humza Yousaf. He was playing with him. He was tormenting him. It was pure badness.
Yeah.
Mark Geisler does a Sunday morning thing on BBC Scotland, and he kind of cut to Alex Salmond live, and he was already laughing before they zoomed out of him being in the corner of the screen. You know, he was absolutely loving it.
What about the effect of
Alex Salmond?
Yeah,
he's enjoying their absolute misery. But if he could, off the back of it, get back into Holyrood, of course he'd like to. He's a man with a colossal ego, who doubtless feels he does have unfinished business. And although there's absolutely no chance that he'll ever become First Minister again, that he'll ever get near power, politics is full of people that have got remarkable amounts of self-belief, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. Often to the detriment of other things. And I wonder what, you know, I mean, we think about the general election here and future elections in Scotland and the role that, you know, when Rishi Sunak stands for election, he will be answerable not just for his actions and record, but Liz Truss and Boris Johnson and other things. What impact, maybe it's hard to quantify, is all the scandal on the SNP, the nature of the downfall of Alex Salmond, his conduct, and his then work for Russia Today, Sturgeon being arrested and her husband being charged, from a party that so often effectively saw itself as the conscience of politics and of being morally superior to its opponents. And I think it probably still believes that, despite all this, that as well as their record in other areas and their failure in other areas, there is a sense that actually these people, as is always the way with politicians who sell themselves as morally superior, often turn out to be not just as morally corruptible as their opponents, but often way worse.
Well, absolutely. The Alex Salmond thing, I don't think particularly did harm the SNP. The people who were yet to be persuaded on independence were not Alex Salmond fans. You know, the SNP didn't lose in 2014 because people hadn't seen enough Alex Salmond, you know. So he'd sort of served his purpose for the SNP. So, because Nicola was sort of super popular and she was a shiny new version, and you could forget all the terrible things about Alex Salmond being an awful old horror, because now we had this shiny, super progressive woman that everyone who watched Question Time loved. So that was fine. But yeah, no, you are right, however, that what's then happened to Nicola Sturgeon has had an impact on the party. You know, the SNP lost the by-election in Rutherglen and Hamilton West last year to Labour, and they lost it really by a thumping amount. Labour got more than half the vote. Now, the SNP MP had to stand down because she'd broken COVID laws and got on a train after being diagnosed. However, I don't think anyone, Labour or SNP, would suggest that the police investigation into the SNP's finances didn't help Labour. And of course, that could go on and on and on for months. This is another thing that the next leader of the SNP has got to look forward to. They get to have to try and please lots of young people who want to give kids puberty blockers, lots of older politicians who don't want to do that. They have to please independent supporters who would have them declare a unilateral declaration of independence tomorrow. And they have to please people who would like a nice gradualist approach, perhaps with a bit more enhanced evolution. And all the while they're doing that, there's just this, they're walking through this minefield of not knowing when the next explosion of this police investigation is going to take place. It's an absolutely miserable, it's like one of those Japanese game shows that used to be on the Clive James thing, you know, where they would just absolutely torture someone. It just feels this is like Squid Game politics.
Yeah.
Poor swine is going to get this job. I have to try and please all these deranged groups of people, these furiously, furiously angry, desperate groups of angry nationalists at the same time, just waiting for Police Scotland to drop another hand grenade into the pen.
Do you think they have much insight into how much of the culture wars they are responsible for? You know, Hamza Yousaf, when he resigned, talking about those who want to weaponize the culture war, and this from a first minister who's taken the decisions that we've described, and when you talk about the reforms to the Gender Recognition Act and the way that the party talks about its opponents and the way that it demonizes people and the way that it campaigns in referendums and local and general elections, when Nicola Sturgeon talked about people watching their tone. When you think about some of the things that party has said about its opponents, do they just not really care that much? Or do you think they genuinely don't realise how responsible they are for what's happened in Scottish politics?
There are some people who do recognise it. And I think those are the people whose concern ultimately forced his hand. You know, there are those people on the backbenches who think, well, hold on a minute, I don't want to have, I'm getting really weary about having to answer questions about Gender Reform Act from a really angry parent. You know, so no, there are people who do in the party who know fine and well. I think for Hamza Youssef, I just think he didn't have his eye on the ball on that issue. There are a lot of male politicians are hopeless on this. They're really late to the party, even very senior ones. I mean, Keir Starmer's really late to exploring with any kind of candor his feelings in public about this. It's taken a long time, I think, especially for male politicians. To talk about this. So I think it was one of these subjects that it would have suited Hamza Youssef not to have to get involved with. And I suspect hadn't, in common with a lot of male politicians, hadn't given the arguments of a lot of feminists who had raised concerns much consideration. Instead, you know, he'd been able to say, well, Nicola Sturgeon says it's progressive, it must be progressive. So I think there's a degree of that, you know, and a lack of self-reflection there.
So what do you think happens now with the SNP? So let's say, well, at the moment, maybe it's John Swinney, maybe it's not. But what do you think happens at the general election and maybe at the Holyrood election? Do you think Labour win more seats than
Yes.
the SNP at both?
Yes. I think, well, we still don't know if there still could be an early Holyrood election. If they're unable to find a new first minister, then there will have to be an election. But that won't break the Holyrood election cycle. So that there'll still have to be another Holyrood election in 2026.
Jesus.
You know, because they're on that fixed, their fixed
Yeah,
parliament.
yeah.
So this would just be about kind of completing a fixed parliament, if you like. Because we haven't had a full fixed parliament yet. You know, we couldn't block that off. So we would so I think if they lost, not if there was an election now, I think they would really be hammered. But I'm not sure that any of the parties really want another Holyrood election now.
Why not?
Well, I think that people are I think people are I get the feeling that voters are absolutely in the zone when it comes to the general election. I feel like there's a real appetite for a general election. You know, the meme of the, oh, not another one woman, I think
Yeah.
that's had its day, you know,
Yeah.
the feeling that people are ready to, I think, to give this lot a kicking. But if there had to be another Holyrood election, well, it happened to be very soon, and the Scottish schools break up at the end of June. And you know, people have got other things in their mind, and you know, like there is a sort of, you know, not everyone's obsessed as obsessed with politics as you and I and all the wise listeners of your podcast are. And there will be plenty of people that will just think, what is wrong with you people? Can't you just run a bloody government? And I don't think that, I think for, you know, I think Labour would win it, but I don't think any of the parties really want an election in those circumstances.
Let's pretend that you are an SNP advisor, or that you choose out of the goodness of your heart to give them genuine good advice that would really help them. What would you advise the SNP to do to either minimise their loss of seats or even emerge as the largest party in those next two elections?
Right, well, the first thing that the next SNP leader has to do is to be honest with the party about the prospect of another independence referendum. They just have to get up and say, look, it is now over for a generation. And that's the SNP's fault. The SNP said this was a once in a generation thing, lost it, and then spent every waking minute telling the people of Scotland that they wanted another referendum, despite poll after poll after poll telling the SNP that the people of Scotland did not yet want another referendum. So the SNP, in maintaining this myth that NDRF2 is around the corner, have not only misled their own members, which is really unhealthy, but they've also taken their eye off the policy agenda. Because ministers are constantly thinking about, well, where can I score a quick point on the constitutional fight, rather than how can I wrestle with this really difficult problem in health and education. And admitting that a referendum is not in the horizon will set the next leader of the SNP free. It will set them free from the expectation that that's going to happen, and it will set them free from the worry that taking on some kind of necessary bit of reform might harm the constitutional battle. Because the SNP, for 17 years now, hasn't taken a decision, or very rarely, I think maybe until the gender stuff, had never taken a decision without one eye to how it would play if it came up during a referendum campaign. Could anything that they did be used to beat them during a referendum campaign? So all that does is creates really timid government. So you can't have, you've got an NHS that the last time there was any reform in the NHS, it was driven by the Labour Party. And they've been out of power since 2007. So no reform in the NHS because they don't want to they don't want to do anything difficult. No reform in schools because they don't want to take on vested interests there or have difficult discussions with unions. And that might hurt the constitutional question. So my bit of advice to the next leader would be to liberate yourself by being honest about the fact there's not going to be another referendum. And then do what all of your predecessors have claimed they would do, which is try to win the argument by displaying that you can actually competently do things. You can actually use the powers of devolution to make a real difference. Scotland's got loads of powers, and the SNP has won lots more powers. The SNP wasn't betrayed by the vow, as they claim. The SNP, after the referendum, won a load more powers through the Smith Commission meeting. Use those powers. Don't just keep saying, if only we had all the powers. So I think that the next leader of the SNP, if they want to have some kind of, if they want to have any kind of legacy, if that matters to them, genuinely focusing on a domestic policy issue that matters to voters, that's the sensible thing to do. And if you get up there from day one, just banging the drum for independence and playing to that part of your support, I think you'll find that you're playing to an ever-dwindling audience.
Ewan, this is, as it was last time, an absolute privilege. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's always great. It's always great. And listen, I'm really glad you're back in the saddle. You're sounding great.
Oh, cheers, mate. Thank you. And, I'll be back up in Scotland soon.
Oh, I look forward to that. Take it easy, man.
Well, there you go. My word, absolutely incredible, the drama in Scottish politics at the moment, and specifically in the SNP and their relationship with the Scottish Greens. Who knows who will become the next leader of the SNP and the next leader of Scotland? But it's fascinating seeing really the parallels, I guess, with what's happening to the Tories in Westminster is two parties in government that are basically collapsing and tearing through leaders in office at an incredible rate. So we're about to have our third SNP First Minister since the last Holyrood election, and obviously we're on our third Prime Minister since the last election as well. All of which, of course, is great material for a political comedian like me. So I will see you at the Soho Theatre from the 28th of May, at the Edinburgh Festival from the 1st of August, and then nationwide. But of course, the link to the Soho Theatre dates is already up, so you can click on that. I will see you next week with another brilliant guest. For now, ta-ra.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.